Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Circus Podcast, number 87.
Shmonim Vesheva. That's Hebrew.
Hey, everybody. Coming at you this week from the great state of New Hampshire and New England. You know, the live free or die state.
Yeah, It's interesting. When we drove up to New Hampshire around the election last time, and there was a ton of Trump signs. And then we drove up again, I don't know, like a month ago, and they were all like kind of decrepit. And then we drove up this week, and they're kind of like back to like looking more pristine. So I feel like every time we drive to New Hampshire, I can see how the country's feeling by the signs we pass.
Yes. I mean, New Hampshire is definitely one of those more political states. It's also quite a circusy state. There's a whole bunch of places that, particularly like Waldorf schools that from New Hampshire that have sent a lot of kids off into professional circus lives.
It's an interesting state, isn't it?
It's
a weird little
mix of everything.
It is.
But it's a great place to record. Nice, quiet background.
Yeah.
We're going to try to keep this episode a little bit more positive and light than the last few, because there is some good news happening in the circus industry to share and spread around.
Yeah.
The first one takes place actually in Nevada, in Las Vegas.
Oh, you say Nevada?
Or Nevada. I think
Nevada.
If you're from Nevada, you say Nevada.
Do I say, let's see, Nevada. I think I say Nevada. I've never thought about it. Tomato, potato, patata.
But past podcast guest, very, very close friend of ours, and star of the Misbehave Game Show, Brett Pfister, recently directed a brand new outdoor show called Salvage City, which had its premiere, I believe, last week.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, went kind of under the radar a little bit. I know Brett was, you know, building up the mystery of it and kind of the vibe behind it. But the Las Vegas Review Journal just released a glowing review. But it's pretty cool. I mean, the whole show sounds like it's outdoors in a drive-in movie theater kind of space.
Yeah, it seems like the space that was already set up for kind of live entertainment with a drive-in component. So the ideal spot for a post-COVID show.
But it sounds like Brett pulled together 30 performers, both from the Spiegelworld family and from Cirque du Soleil in Las Vegas. They did three shows. There was a food component, an alcohol component, an immersive component. Sounds like they got like a crane outside in this drive-through in order to do aerials.
But it was produced by Insomniac and David Foster.
So David Foster of Spiegelworld fame, and Insomniac, I believe, is like a electronic music promoter.
Electronic musical is what we would be watching. Electronic music carnival is what we would not be at. But I always dream of me being cool enough to go to one of those things. But
so like an EDC kind of venue.
Yeah, but I just get so anxious when there's so many people.
Well, we're probably at least cool enough to go to Salvage City, which is also quite a sweet, you know, post-apocalyptic
name.
It'll be interesting to see where Brett and the team take this. I could definitely see it like living in Las Vegas, having this new outdoor show in Las Vegas. I could see it touring and
I guess I could go to festivals like that where it's like big outdoor spaces. That makes sense. But it wouldn't really be a typical tour, which is probably a fun thing. But then again, you also have to have these although outdoor festivals are probably going to be fine in a way because it's outdoors. It seems like a really cool use of the time and space. And I don't know, if it were me, I'd probably just keep it in Vegas.
Make it a little Vegas secret.
Yeah.
But
it depends on how many tourists are going to come to Vegas. I don't know. So now we get to the business plan of this whole show. but theoretically, it's really cool.
Yeah. I mean, it's just great that people are putting on outdoor live entertainment and like using performers who are currently just sitting on their hands waiting for their various shows to reopen. Like, I think we're finally this fall starting to see action happening across the board. Another happy sort of we're back on stage kind of story came out this week from Chicago with Midnight Circus, which is an awesome organization. We've talked about a bunch, but they spent the last 2 months fundraising about $50,000 in order to be able to put on an outdoor small tour in Chicago in different parks. I believe they're going to four different parks. They just reached their fundraising goal last week. So they're going to do outdoor shows as well in, I believe it's next month.
Well, going back to the Salvage City, the drive-in idea, one of the kind of negatives in the article, which I was always thinking about when I saw like dance pieces being done in a parking lot with people in a circle is there's a lot of sightline issues in cars. Because when you're driving, there's like blind spots and there's, you know, the caging of the car, and that, I guess, depending on where you are, it's hard to see the performers. And if that affects people wanting to go, you know, like.
Well, on the flip side, a show like Midnight, you're going to be sitting on the grass in a park.
Yeah.
Totally outdoors with a blanket you probably bring yourself. Days of comfortable padded seating.
Yeah.
You know, where everybody has good sight lines is still a ways away.
Yeah.
You know, the outdoor period, whether that's in your car, whether that's in a park, I think is an exciting / interesting opportunity. You and I are going to talk about in a moment how sort of we're exploring that for.
Well, we had an idea like 7 years ago about a show in a tent that took place on a field. And, you know, everyone sat in blankets. So we were basically predicting coronavirus times.
Just too early.
Yeah, just too early.
But, you know, if you live in Las Vegas, if you live in Chicago, go support these organizations and these shows. I mean, I think we were speaking to a set designer the other day about how we think this year is going to go, because we're developing. We have, of course, Beyond Babel, which is going to be on tour next year. We're working on a new project as well and trying to figure out how busy everyone's going to be this time next year, whether that's the designer, whether that's the costume shop or the scenic shop making stuff for the show, whether that's the performers. Because right now, everyone is still kind of available. And the date in which people are, you know, aiming to go back is constantly shifting and changing.
Well, what I am confused by is the season that just like never was. What happens with those shows? Are they getting pushed back to 21, 22? Are they not getting pushed back because there's already shows slated for 21, 22? So do they just not happen? Do the shows slated for 21, 22 aren't able to happen? Do the, you know, like all of the questions of like, can you keep your cast and crew together for a whole year and then be open? What if they had something after that? It's interesting to see like if the costume set, lighting, all of these big shops, if they're actually going to be super, super busy, or if it's almost like they're starting just like a new season with kind of a new slate of shows
for them to like make things for.
Yeah. Or is it that they're going to be packed with making stuff for the shows that were supposed to happen? Because theoretically, you still have the same amount of performance opportunities, right?
Like locations you can perform.
Yeah.
Who knows? You know, that's a big question mark for me. You know, the further out you go in the industry, like the vendors like that, you know, shows that were supposed to happen in the fall or the spring rather, and then got pushed to the fall and now get pushed to next year. You know, that it also includes Drawn to Life, which is the new Cirque du Soleil show at Disney, which we'd been speculating a little bit about. They'd previously said they were going to aim to open this fall. As of last week, they're now aiming to open in February. And Disney's announced they're going to redo the theater in the meantime. So I think Disney's looking at how they can redo the HVAC, how they can redo seating, the different ways in which they can upgrade the actual theater experience in the building that used to host La Nuba for the next show.
I did see La Nuba.
I had only saw it on video, but that's a real classic. It's where Tramp Wall was popularized.
So there was a thing that was like the first live performance back in New York City, but it was more of a fundraiser, and it was done at this rehearsal space called Open Jar in Manhattan, which is actually where we had the auditions for Beyond Babel. And it's a huge room, and they set up tables like in a U shape, kind of around a stage that was they put up, and everyone sat in their own seat with plexiglass between them, and it was maybe for 40 people. Which is great for a fundraiser or something like small where you could do it, but in a theater, the practicality of that is just so small. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. And then the other question is if these shops are all open when, like, still open when we finally come back, because a lot of them still are trying to survive this time and stay open. Like the costume shops are trying to find a way to weather this storm. Like everyone else is, but like, are they all going to be there when we come back? So is that why everyone's going to be more like busy, because there's going to be less people making costume sets?
Supply.
Yeah.
Yeah, we will see, I guess. That's really the only answer to that.
I know, but it's an interesting conversation when we're talking to set designers and lighting designers for new projects, because where they would typically bid for things might not be existing. Like our lighting package that we have is still just sitting in the theater, because who knows what's happening with the lighting
rental company.
I mean, it's all these questions that are interesting when you're trying to start a new project.
It's true. And just, you know, as I think about what shows have said they're going to reopen, I believe Pippin, the Broadway musical that Seven Fingers collabed on, is opening in Australia. I think in November they were aiming for and are still on target. So that's another example of a circus-esque show musical aiming for the fall.
Although Australia doesn't seem nearly as bad as, and that's a show that was already made, already has all the properties to it.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, our guest today, Jorgen Lifschitz, is Australian and the founder of a big, important Australian circus company. And he sort of talks about the impact of circus on the Australian arts sector and how the arts sector in general impacts everything else. So we won't dive too much into that right now, because we do talk about it a decent amount with Jorgen. But I think this is the beginning of people making plans. We have finally gotten now, as we're into September 2020, we've gone from we don't know what's going to happen when or where or how to now we still don't really know for sure, but people are starting to like make plans and try to make things happen, which is a really good positive looking indicator for the future. Including the people who are trying to make plans for the future are you and I.
Yeah.
And of course, like we mentioned, we have our dance show Beyond Babel, which is just going to reopen as soon as it's possible to do. It's going to reopen in New York. It's going to tour around the U.S. Next year and the following year, and then hopefully Europe the year after that or the season after that. But in the meantime, we're developing a new circus project, because
which is very exciting.
You know, you and I have been in the hip hop dance world for 3 years now, yeah, pretty much nonstop, really getting to understand it and promote our show. And, you know, really have found a love for it. But our true first love, at least my true first love, you know, has been a little far away. And we wanted to circle back to creating a brand new circus show, an American circus show for America. And I think we're going to be able to pull it off for 2021. We found a venue, an outdoor venue for the fall, and a possible place to make the show. We have a really exciting show concept. I don't really want to divulge it, honestly, on the podcast, at least not yet. Maybe we'll tease it, you know, when we get a little bit closer to it. But one thing I will say about it is Lindsay and I are really trying to figure out a way to combine classical, traditional styles of circus and contemporary styles of circus in the same show in a really seamless way that the audience probably wouldn't know. But if you're a real circus person, I think you'll like that we'll find, I think it's a new way to sort of try to combine those two things. You know, Lindsay and I have spent the last couple of weeks putting together the creative team for the show, who's going to be the lighting designer, who's going to be the set designer, costumes,
music.
And those things are coming together quite nicely. And now my brain is starting to turn to how do we cast this show with circus performers. And honestly, I think this is maybe going to be the hardest part about this whole project. And, you know, as somebody who started out on this side of the performing spectrum or the circus spectrum on the casting side, I went from performer to casting assistant to casting director, essentially, or casting manager to the producing side. I feel like this is more of a challenge than ever. Back in the day, you know, a couple of years ago, you know, we would tour the country looking for different acts. Maybe you go to Europe, you look for different acts. You go to festivals, you go to graduations of different circus schools. And none of those things happened this year. And none of those things are happening for the next 6 months at least. So all of the casting we have to
do. Nor can we travel anywhere.
Exactly. We can't travel to find really all that many acts. We have to really rely on the internet and word of mouth and people we know and people they know. And sort of compounding the problem of casting is, you know, where this country, America, is at with immigration. And if you and I have learned anything, it's every time we spend thousands of dollars to get a visa, something happens where the performer can't come, whether that be an injury or coronavirus or something else. But the current administration is just making it more and more difficult, really, for any kinds of foreign workers to come in. So the idea of, say, okay, next year, let's get a bunch of foreign acts sounds really difficult. So we're really going to focus almost entirely on finding acts that are already allowed to work in America. That means people who already have visas or green cards or American citizens, which is just a new layer of complexity to the problem.
The two exciting things about that is, one, that most American performers are always in Europe or Canada or Asia or Australia doing a show, and most of them are back here. So I hope that we can create a show that keeps American performers in America and, you know, really high level performers, which is always the like, oh, all these performers are so good. And then they leave the country to go elsewhere because there's not so much work. So that's one exciting thing. Or people that can work in America, not just Americans, but people that, you know, have the visas and stuff to work in America. Like, that's really exciting, I think, to be able to have a show that will create more, hopefully more performing jobs. Two, the other exciting thing about that is that you kind of, it's almost like a blank slate of casting in a way. It's like kind of going back to like square one a little bit, like rethinking how you cast things. I don't know. I think this time of is like, you have to think of it as exciting because it's like more of a challenge.
Man, I see just so many challenges with the casting of the show, because there's a few different ways to cast a project. You can do a totally open call, either on the internet or in person, where you just say, hey, we're looking for circus performers, like apply, here's the details. You could do the opposite of that, which would just be going individually to acts you know already and offer them jobs like, hey, Lindsay, here's a contract, I'd love you to do this thing. You can go off of recommendations. You can go off of lots of different kinds of ways of finding people. And they all sort of have their pros and cons. You know, just as an individual, I know surely hundreds of acts, but I know there are thousands I don't know, and definitely Americans I don't know who've been on tour with, say, Cirque du Soleil for the last decade, who have not really been on the market, essentially, other than Cirque du Soleil, you know, track, who I don't know about. And part of me wants to just cast a show with all of my friends and the people who I think are amazing. But part of me also wants to find people I've never found before and work with and bring new people and voices onto the stage. But it goes one of two ways, right? You open the casting pool to everybody. What that allows for is a really inclusive application process. Anybody from any background can apply. But because there's only probably 8 to 12 onstage performing jobs, that means the amount, our acceptance rate is going to be like 1%, yeah, as it kind of was for Beyond Babel.
But I feel like with Beyond Babel, when we did an open casting call, it allowed, I think, having the opportunity to apply or submit for something. Like, when I was a performer, always the annoying thing was like, oh, why? There was never, like, if it was equity, you had to have an open call, right? But still, it's not like a real open call. But it was always like, oh, I wish I could have submitted for this, you know, and just the ability to submit and not be like, oh, this was like totally privately cast, like I had no chance because I didn't even know the people, blah, blah, blah.
I just worry about the backlash of all of these people applying, all these people, I hope lots of people apply for it, but people applying, and then it's just painful when you take a really small amount because it's just a very high rejection percentage. And you don't have that when you go out individually to a person and then another person and then another person, because you're not exposing so many people to potential rejection. I think we'll probably do something in between. I definitely want to do an open casting call. It's a shame that it has to be online, because in another universe, we could have had people meet in Montreal or meet in New York or meet in Las Vegas and try to actually get people in front of us, or just us go to different festivals or different shows and see it. So this is going to be a really new challenge, and trying to figure out the right way to balance the cast on stage. Of course, we want really nice gender balance, really nice racial balance, really nice just background balance where people have been trained, styles of performance, different age balance. But these things are not so easy to do. And we're going to figure out a way to pull it off so that our cast represents, you know, the world that we live in. But this is my ask to our podcast listeners. If you're an amazing performer, or you know an amazing performer who deserves to be on stage, has the skills, really would be amazing in this context of both classical and contemporary techniques. We are looking honestly for people who have that A+ level of technique. If you're in circus school, if you're an amateur turning pro, feel free to apply. But we really are trying to find some of the best performers in the world, or the upcoming best performers in the world.
Well, that also being said, I think one thing that Josh and I are really trying to also kind of Shepherd is the ability and opportunity for people to like basically learn the backside of it all and maybe sit in on a tech rehearsal or a, you know, just rehearsal process. Because I think part of the other problem with this conversation, or a problem that we've realized through these conversations, is that the opportunities for young people to be a part of circus and grow into it, you know, and in theater, is they don't have the opportunity to like be a part of it. So if you know anyone too who like is interested in learning and seeing the producing side, the directing side, the lighting design side, you know, send them our way too, because hopefully at some point during our rehearsal process we can invite people into it and can see a little bit. Because I know that was incredibly like impactful for me when I was younger, was to sit in and watch a rehearsal and see like what everyone behind the scenes was doing. Because I think as a young person, you don't necessarily know all the backstage stuff, you know, the on stage. And once I saw that, I was like, oh my God, I want to be a, you know, on the administrative side and help produce these shows.
Or the design side, if that tickles your fancy. We're talking about August, September, October, maybe even November of 2021, for those of you who are now opening your calendars trying to figure out if it will fit in there. So again, if you're an American circus performer, if you know American circus performers or people who are allowed to work here already, feel free to send us an email at hello@howtoacircus. We will probably in the next couple of weeks put a proper casting notice online. I'm sure we'll talk about it again on the podcast. If you have different resources and places you think we should be looking for these acts, feel free to ping us an email. I went through Circus Talk's website the other day, just looking at the acts that are available in North America. And it's a very good resource. And of course, we love our friends at Circus Talk and constantly recommend them in the various different things, whether it be their news feature or job feature or ticketing feature. But it is a limited way when you're just looking at it online. And you know, recommendations are often the best way we found people. I mean, our previous show, Slumber, was recommended to us by a number. The people in it were recommended to us by a number of past podcast guests. Mm. And that was super helpful in finding people who sort of matched our energy. And I guess one last thing I would say about this is that we got very fortunate when we put together the Beyond Babel cast, because we had a lot of young people who hadn't been in a lot of shows before, and it really left us and Keone and Mari, our choreographers and co-creators, a lot of space to create a culture. And I think the culture we created with the cast and the team on Beyond Babel is really special and really positive and really focused on growth and personal development and being accountable to one another and being supportive, almost in the way a sports team might be.
Yeah.
And I want to do that again with this show. So we're really looking for performers and people who are, you know, interested in creating an ensemble that
is a team.
Is a team, and, you know, is a really positive atmosphere to be around. And of course, there are amazing acts who maybe can juggle 12 balls or do quadruple backflips, but don't have the right attitude. You know, that's not exactly what we're looking for. We're looking for people who really have amazing skills and are interested in, you know, creating a really special performing company to do something really amazing with us.
Yeah.
Next year.
Yeah. So here's for positivity.
Here's for positivity. Here's for people making plans for 2021 and even shows for the fall of 2020. Props to Brett Pfister. Props to Midnight Circus, Jeff and Julie Jenkins. Props to everybody else who's figuring out ways to put on shows. I believe Aaron Marquis, who runs a circus program in upstate New York, is also putting on a show with Kyle Driggs outdoors. I don't know if I have all the details on that yet, but people are doing it. So if you live in places where people are putting on outdoor circus shows, go see them, go support them. It's definitely worth it. And we'll keep you up to date as more things start to find ways to reopen, including our own things.
Yeah. But in the meantime, we'll try to keep, you know, hitting you up with podcasts.
And today's guest is Joran Lifschitz, who is the founder of the circus company based in Australia called Circa, which I think a lot of New Yorkers hopefully will have seen. They performed at NYU, they performed at Lincoln Center, they performed at BAM, they performed at a church right by Columbia University.
They really are like a quintessential Australian circus company. If I, you know, I think Joran kind of pushed back a little bit on my idea of Australian circus. He agreed with it, but also pushed back a bit. But to me, the current Australian circus is a lot of ground ensemble work. And Circa is that to me.
And urine is very much part of the wave that brought that to Australia. And he has just loads of interesting ideas about where theater and circus fit and overlap or don't. And he just currently put out a new podcast called Producing Heroes, which is an interview podcast like ours, but focuses predominantly on interviewing producers and festival programmers. And I've been really enjoying that. So I'm super excited to talk to Euron. I think you guys will like it. Before we let you listen to the podcast,
if you like our podcast, make sure to subscribe on iTunes, follow us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com.
Oh, and one thing I didn't shout out was that Circa is also doing a show called Leviathan, I believe, in Brisbane. With a whole bunch of people in the next couple of weeks. So they're another example of companies that are starting to put things back on the road.
So if you're in Australia, go on out.
Enjoy our episode with Euron. Euron, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. I'm so excited to talk with you. Where are we reaching you at the moment?
I am in my office in Brisbane, Australia. And being in an office is, of course, a wonderful thing in this moment. Being able to be out of my house. So that's a rare treat.
And you're not originally an Australian, correct? Or are you?
No, I was born in South Africa and I grew up, I moved here when I was 10.
For your parents' work or for any particular reason?
Yeah, my parents had been wanting to emigrate from South Africa for a long time. My dad grew up in the States. I don't think they ever felt very comfortable with the system in South Africa or felt like it was a long-term proposition for them. South Africa was one of the few places where Jews tended to be able to get in before the war, so it was kind of a sort of stop-off point. Mm-hmm. But I think they felt that there'd be a longer-term future for our family somewhere else, and they alighted on Australia.
Josh's grandfather lives in Israel with his long-term girlfriend of 15 years.
He's 95, my grandma.
Yeah. But she also is from South Africa, and then they left
for similar reasons, probably around a similar time.
Yeah, great.
Australia, as a 10-year-old, that's quite a change, I guess, going from South Africa to Australia.
Yeah, look, I think that the experience of emigrating is profound. You kind of just leave everything. And look, we did it in a way. We weren't on a leaky boat. We had visas. We had a job in the other end. You know, like we were incredibly lucky. But the psychological kind of trauma of that experience, I think, is often understated, even when you do it in comparative kind of luxury. And of course, my grandparents had emigrated to South Africa, so it was kind of it wasn't like we were leaving, you know, the family castle. We were leaving kind of what had been a temporary place. And I grew up knowing that you had to have a passport. If you didn't have a valid passport, you probably didn't have a chance ultimately. So I always grew up thinking that there was a sort of degree of temporiness about whatever kind of circumstances you found yourself in. And that was really tethered a lot to luck. You know, like, did you happen to be a Tamil or a Jew or a, you know, whatever the particular caste that was being persecuted by the particular people at a particular moment just seemed to be kind of more or less a random wheel of fortune. And your job was to kind of prepare for it and expect the anvil of destiny to land on your head at some kind of periodic interval that you were never quite sure when it would be.
Or multiple intervals possibly as well.
That's right. Yeah. It doesn't stop, but you just don't know when it's going to come. So you make hay with a cloudy disposition, I think. And I think that's kind of, you have a good relationship, I think, with the sense of your own sort of luck and absurdity at that luck.
Was there some kind of live performance that you saw either in South Africa or in Australia when you were younger that made you want to go in that direction?
No, the exact opposite. The only thing that I saw really that I can remember seeing was an interminable production of Annie when I was 4 years old.
Classic.
The song Tomorrow seemed to go on until tomorrow, and I fell asleep, and I really didn't enjoy going to the theater. And I never really got out of the habit of not enjoying going to the theater. I wasn't a kind of theater baby. I didn't dance, act, sing, perform. What I think I do is have a sense for me that theater is part of our, and culture more generally, is part of our duty. It's part of what makes us a good kind of species, that somehow gathering in a public space to have intense private experiences and connecting our experience with others is a kind of valid form of something that makes us civilized. And, you know, I go kind of, it's cold here in Brisbane at the moment. That means it's like middle of winter, so we're like 40 degrees in the morning, but for us that's really cold, right? And I go running in the cold, and I don't enjoy the experience of heading out into that cold, dark 5 a.m. morning, but I love it at the end of it, and I know it's good for me. And that's very much how I experienced art and theater. I think there's nothing wrong with entertainment, but it's never been my path or my calling is to make work that entertains people. Thankfully, because I've certainly done quite a lot of not entertaining people. I think mostly what I do is what attracted me to it was a sense that here was a world that made some kind of sense, where there were clear roles and demarcations. As you could probably see behind me, I'm a really messy person. There's stuff everywhere in my life. And the theater was a clean space. It was a blank canvas where you could write very clean lines that I can't in my handwriting or in my normal life. And it seemed to me a kind of place where important things could be said and done and thought about. I don't know if that's true. I can't guarantee that that's still the case, but certainly what drew me to it was feeling that it was a place where everybody agreed that for the next hour or however long, the most important things in the world were going to happen in that room, and that every single person involved, from the usher to the stage manager to the performers to the audience, were just presently there for something to actually happen. And I kind of intuited pretty early on in that was something kind of quite profound and beautiful, and unlike most things that happened in life, where we stayed in the main, we kind of just stayed living our life, and in theatre you kind of stop. And that's what attracted me to it. But it certainly wasn't seeing shows, because I did then, and I've continued a very long lifelong tradition, actually, of falling asleep in almost everything. Because it's boring. I mean, most theatre is excruciatingly boring. You know that episode of The Simpsons where Homer goes up to the bear in the rundown kind of amusement park and says, I've seen plays that are more interesting than this. As God is my witness, plays. And that's exactly how I feel. And I trained to be a theater director, so I can speak with some authority.
What was your introduction to circus? Because so my background is circus since I was a kid, but Lindsay, similar to you, spent a long time in theater prior to really getting to know the circus world.
Yeah, I am a complete outsider in anything that I like to do. So I work in the theatre, which was outside most of what I was expected to do, going to kind of become a doctor or a lawyer or something. I was training to be an academic. I wanted to be a historian. And, there was a door and all these kind of interesting, exciting, sexy-looking people walked through that door. And then all my history mates and myself walked through this door. So I thought, I wonder what's through that door. And it turned out to be this kind of theater, this thing that I'd recognized and was interested in but had never really spent much time with. So I spent a lot of time with it. And I was working after I finished drama school, I worked in a natural history museum. We did a couple of kind of physical shows and events, had people come down walls and stuff. And I kind of liked it, but I didn't particularly didn't strike me as being inherently more or less interesting than what I was doing, which wasn't very interesting. So I was kind of looking, but I'd always had the feeling that one of the things that I could probably do quite well was mine a particular conversation or particular genre And there were three companies in Australia that I thought, well, look, if one of these companies comes up, I should apply for them to be the artistic director. And one was a chamber opera company, one was a contemporary puppet company, and one was a circus company up in Brisbane called Rock and Roll Circus. Rock and Roll Circus was, as I later discovered, about to be defunded. It was on its last legs. It had been set up as a collective. It had done very important work, but had kind of, as a lot of collectives do, when most of the members change and you've got some kind of, you know, you're still a fairly young body, but with some really kind of arteriosclerotic kind of wiring, you're kind of about to fall over. They'd been told they needed an artistic director, and I became it. So I was interested in circus as a kind of an intellectual proposition more than a thing. I'd always enjoyed it. Like, I'd always kind of gone, well, at least somebody's doing something that's kind of cool and dangerous and fun. At least that's a good thing. I'm getting some energy off this thing. I never really believed it very much. I never believed when the tissue artist pretended that their tissue was washing on the line. I went, no, it's a tissue and that's a piece of string and that doesn't look like a washing line. So I don't know why you're doing that. Like, especially when you spent years training to do this thing and then you're pretending it's not this thing. That never made any sense to me whatsoever. But I realized then, as I still realize now, that I have an awful lot to learn.
When you were in drama school, did you study directing then? Was that like your major?
Yeah, that's right. I went to the National Institute here and I studied directing. And we did no circus.
No. Most theater schools don't even talk about circus. I mean, I didn't even really know what the world existed until I met Josh at grad school for theater. And it was like, oh, wow, this whole world.
So they say, you know, the devil comes in many guises. He led you down the, you know, you could have been directing, you know,
the successful next line Broadway shows. Yeah, exactly.
And he said, you're doing a podcast. We're doing a podcast with each other. So there we have it.
Did you find though that when you were at theater school, you were attracted to any specific type of work, like more modern plays or old school plays or?
Yeah, look, I mean, doesn't everyone think they're going to be like the next Peter Brook, Bob Wilson? Like, everyone thinks they're a genius. And, you know, and then what was really interesting was just how bad my work was. Like, you know, my graduating play at theater school, my actors were Cate Blanchett, Daniel Lapaine, who's, you know, a fairly big Australian film actor, another very good actor. I did a, you know.
Wait, they were like, actors in your thesis?
Yeah, they were actors in my graduating project. Yeah, it was a fabulous project. And I still managed to make it suck. You know, like I just kind of, because it's always struck me that it was kind of like having a play was like, for me, was rocking up to a party carrying bags of cement. You were there to kind of have this sort of ecstatic human interaction, and you had to sort of digest all these kind of lumpy words and try not to get them to weigh you down. But I didn't know what to do with that, so I started to make devised work. I worked in museums, I worked in did some work in opera, and kind of, you know, there's this kind of Gollum-like moment where you kind of put your finger in the forehead of the clay and hope it comes to life, and it generally doesn't. It's generally just a bunch of clay, and there's a hand, and there's a head, and you can sort of light it well and pretend it's open. But it's really hard to get the thing to actually spring to life and surprise you and kind of amaze you. And that didn't happen very often. I saw flashes of it. Like I kept seeing like a glimpse through a door. Just kind of a little crack of something. Oh, there's something in that moment. But I could never figure out what it was. And, you know, I'm in creation. I'm in rehearsal right at the moment for two new creations. And that's kind of exactly how I feel. Like, I feel like my hit rate's gone up. I can generally find, I can kind of end run my own kind of problems and invoke the possibility of that moment of life more often, but not that often.
Do you feel like there's something that circus can express better or in a more special way than other art forms can?
Look, I think that the essence for me of what circus does so well is be intensely alive and present. And I think we have, because theater went to literature and somehow other things got to go to kind of music and poetry, but theater went to literature. And literature got taught by English teachers. We've become trained to look at meaning as if it's a really important thing. And I think there's nothing less meaningful in the theater than meaning. Theater does it. What was the last thing you learned from the theater? I mean, you go to the theater to have someone tell you that the theme is that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. You already know that. I mean, sitting through 2 hours.
Play we just saw. Do that writer, Alice Birch?
No, I don't.
That was the theme of the play.
That was the theme of the play.
But you knew that before you went in there. You could have saved 2 hours of your life. You could have read the motto or the notes.
I wish I did.
But no one goes to the theater for meaning. It's just not the place we do. I mean, there are a few exceptions, the kind of, the play where you hear the authentic voices of people telling you stories that you genuinely didn't know happened. Of course, there are kind of political moments in theater and social insight moments that do happen. I still don't think theater is ever really fundamentally about a kind of a field of meaning, much more so circus. I mean, circus is a monumentally inept medium for telling stories. You only have to try and follow the story of a Cirque du Soleil show, which is wondrous outsider meets cool, kooky world full of improbably lycra-clad creatures doing absurd things who all appear to come from, different training schools in China and Russia. I mean, it's like no one believes that story. If you believe that story, you need to kind of, sort of up your reading to something like, a children's book, because honestly, it's really dumb on a meaning level. What it's not dumb on, what theater is not dumb on, is the level of the act of communion between an audience and artist, the kind of presence in space together. It also is not dumb in how it can include visual arts, how it can include music, how it can synthesize arts. It's the ultimate kind of bowerbird or harlot of the theatrical, of the kind of art forms. It's the most generous, capacious, accepting art form, and also the most kind of venal using art form. It'll take anything from anywhere and use it and synthesize it and grab it. And, there's no limits to what you can put inside a theater if you can imagine it and figure out how to afford it and put it in there and how to turn it into an experience for the audience, then it exists. And I think that's part of, I always think about theater. It's like this almost endlessly perfect mixture of everything. It's capitalist and it's communist. It's kind of socialist and it's every politics is in there because it is in there. People make money and there's hierarchies and there's structures, but there's also freedom and opportunity and politics that often are a thing with that. And none of that's seen as being a contradiction. And I think that's why meaning is so unimportant in theater and particularly in circus. Theater is a vessel, it's a platform, it's a kind of a structure in our lives where things happen. It's not a place where you create a simple theme or a set of ideas. And circus particularly is woeful at it and should be, because it's kind of the reason why theater is great has nothing to do with the reason why plays are studied at school.
So I think most of the people who listen to our podcast, the majority are New Yorkers, so they've probably seen Circa in your work at BAM or NYU or potentially, I know you did one at a cathedral up by Columbia at one point.
We did, yeah.
But I'm wondering just what the genesis story is for Circa and if there's sort of like an artistic thesis behind it that, drives it either as a mission artistically or otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's constantly evolving. I've been at the company for about a little over 20 years, and one of the reasons that I think that's less ridiculous than it sounds is that I've been at the company doesn't feel like it's the same company. It feels like I've been at four or five different companies. So the first one was Rock and Roll Circus. And that was me having the kind of distance and space to learn about this medium. Rock and Roll Circus did some really important pioneering work in Australia in the late 80s and 90s. It was adult, tough, in-your-face circus. It was a mixture of the Australian circus tradition with a bit of our chaos, with a bit of something really authentic. Brisbane has a kind of underground performance arty, kind of more Chicago or Portland, or like has, was all, you know, something a bit kind of counter. So it was Seattle. So it was kind of had this different energy. But it was, like I say, the world had moved on and I think it needed to change. But I spent a couple of years figuring my way out around it. Then I'd been wanting to change the name because I didn't particularly feel that we were circus in that way, and we definitely weren't rock and roll. And I feel like that's a kind of, you know, it was the its highest aspiration could be the poster on a teenager's bedroom wall. And while that's a kind of an important place in life, it's not where my artistic heartland is. So I was very influenced. I started to sort of look around the web, and this was in the days of dial-up modems. You can still, anyone who's old enough to remember, you guys are probably way too young, but I have this kind of terror at that sound.
I know those.
The hope that you might get on, the fear that you might not. It was really probably the most dramatic moment in my life, in my day quite often. But I spent hours looking around, searching, reading, and I was very influenced by the work of William Forsythe at Ballet Frankfurt. Not so much the stage work, which I'd seen a little of and encountered much more on video and other forms, but more the philosophy. And what he said that really opened my mind was, look, I'm not interested in contemporary dance. I'm interested in ballet and applying contemporary art practice to what ballet is. And I thought that's very similar to me. So we started to kind of explore circus as a kind of set of languages and then applying contemporary arts, practice, thinking, philosophies to that. That pretty much alienated anybody who still came to see our shows. I mean, we seriously, no one came. We got terrible reviews for 6 years. We just kind of, it was like we were kind of dudes doing things that shouldn't have been done with the medium and often didn't work very well. We kept seeing, again, more flashes of light, but, you know, it takes a lot of sparks to make a fire, and we definitely only had sparks. In the middle of that process, we changed the name. We then kind of made small shows that grew to bigger shows and then more diverse range of shows, and I think now the company's in the current phase is very much on a mixture where we're looking at both creating more sustainable value for the company going forward, more adventurous projects and particularly collaborations, which is something we didn't do a lot of in the early days, and also radically revising our programs of engagement, making us a much more diverse and sustainable organization. Really rethinking a lot of things that we've done bits of, but never really thought from the ground up. How can we create a better world through what we do? And I think that's because you need to do that from a position of confidence and strength if you're going to have your maximum effectiveness. And I feel like we're probably at least theoretically entering that space. I don't know if we're going to get away with any of it, but then one of the things about, you know, we've always kind of treated the company very much like it's a circus act. You do a lot of training, you prepare, but then ultimately you go out there and do really risky stuff, and you're kind of constantly aware that it just might not work. You might drop the juggling balls or land on your face, and it could be the end of, you know, anything you do, God forbid, could be the end of your career or, you know, worse. So you should kind of love it and make it last and, try to make it good, right?
Yes, and making circus shows good, I've heard among the most important things is casting, and you guys have cast many of my favorite American circus performers. From what I've seen from circus work is a lot of group numbers and a lot of acrobatics and a lot of not dance is maybe how I would describe it. So I'm curious also about how much it's choreographed versus improvised. And how much of it's a dance approach or sort of how the rehearsal room works in that sense.
Yeah, look, I don't think there's a single answer. But what I can say is the two most given notes at Circa are don't dance and don't act. And I love good dance. I feel much more – it's something I've come to kind of later in my life, and I have some – most of the things that I search out for are dance. However, I'm not a choreographer. I don't want our artists to dance. I think what we try and do is to kind of take a something that's already a circus act and look at what we're exploring, the kind of ideas or flavors or emotions behind that which we're kind of trying to dig in a particular show. And we try and fillet the circus act to find certain ideas or certain kind of opportunities that act will have when applied under pressure, when pressure is applied to it, that will cause a kind of a distortion, that will create a kind of ability for that act to become expressive and emotionally powerful. And creating emotionally powerful circus, I think, is one of our trademarks. There's a lot of circuses that have better skills, more, you know, definitely nicer sets and bigger apparatuses and things. We tend to be very stripped back. But there's not a lot, I think, that you walk away from and said, I cried. And I often say that the kind of the zen of our work is you should be able to do a forward roll and make the audience weep. If you can do that, you've kind of got there. And doing that's not easy. I mean, it's incredibly difficult. And to do that, you've got to kind of bring all of yourself to bear, including your ability to move and act and think and talk and do all that stuff. But we also have to be able to challenge it and change it. It's very, very hard to find our artists. When we do a global casting call, we get 500 applicants. We choose two. And usually, and often one of them is wrong. They need to be the right kind of people, and I can't really explain what that is. What I can say is that they are people that are very hardworking. They are very able. They're able to negotiate working inside a company structure with a director on a project that may not be to their choosing or liking, with still having a very high degree of autonomy and ability to bring their creativity and personality to bear, but also knowing when to pull back on that. And those things are all just really, really hard to do.
Do you have an audition?
And they have to be great in teams.
Is there an audition process besides the online application?
Yeah, so we usually have auditions. I mean, we're trying to get to a point where we know who is coming into the company long before they get in. So we've been kind of in time of COVID, for instance, we have a couple of people that we're working with internationally where we know that they're people where we want to work with, but they're not necessarily ready or able to work with us. So we're doing some skills training with them, some drills and stuff online. Some of our ensemble members are spending time with them. I'd like to be doing much more of that. I think that, you know, I'd like Circa to become a major talent foundry. I want us to be a place that you can bring the raw ingredients of great people and energy and aptitude, and we can help it turn into artists. I've often said that one of the things I'm proudest of is that Circa is a place where acrobats come to become artists. And if you look at the companies like GOM, Company 2, Cassis, they're made up of our alumni or people who learned many of their skills or received many of their ideas at Circa. That's not to take credit for their own journeys and work. It's just to say that we should be part of an ecosystem. None of us, we didn't start these. We didn't create the people. We didn't create their training. But they have a time in this journey with us. And a part of that, I think, is also diversity. It pains me that most of the people who come, almost everyone who comes through here is white. Almost everyone is middle class to upper middle class. Circus in Australia is very much a class system. Mm-hmm. The people who can afford to go to university and not do something immediately vocationally focused generally come from a degree of comfort and support behind them. And yet it's an incredibly difficult life. It's not a life that is of the upper middle class. But that, I think, is something that we have to address going forward. I think we can't, it's difficult to do a show like Humans and say, well, this is Humans. They're all white.
We have a off-Broadway dance show, actually. It's called, well, actually, we don't know what it's called because previously to this last month, it's been called Urban Dance.
The genre.
The genre is urban dance, but because the name urban is derived from a term that basically record labels gave this group of African-American artists, the community of urban dancers are now trying to figure out the new term for this genre of dance. But it's interesting because this style of dance comes from teams and crews and not training. So it allows for a bigger grasp of people and not just those who are able to have training. And it's something that I never thought about until, because I always thought circus, it's so inclusive and, you know, and there's so many different types of people. But then when you really look at it, it's like, it is kind of a similar problem to theater where it's, you have the ability to go to school and train and then you go on and on. But one question I have, and I'd love to hear like your thoughts about, is I feel like in Australia, to me, there's like two kind of in everywhere in Europe and in Canada and America and Australia, there's a very specific style I feel like comes from Australia of circus. And it's either like the kind of more adult variety show feeling or this like group acrobatic ground, more grounded work. Do you feel like those are the two main like pillars of Australian circus?
I think there are three, and I think that they're historically, they have very clear genealogy. So there's the first is the kind of larrikin, broad, humid Australian style. So that comes out of Circus Oz, Flying Fruit Fly Circus, the Nanjing training projects, the artists that came through those. That was really the dominant style in Australia in the kind of 80s.
What did you call it?
Larrikin, Australian kind of humor, broad, often features the kind of standard genre of kind of joke is, I can't do it, I can't do it, oh, look, I did it.
Okay.
And it comes into companies like Acrobat and a number of kind of smaller groups, and it's still there. The second strain is the cabaret Spiegel Tent show that obviously Le Clique and the rise of the Spiegel Tent. I think it's also, it has its roots going right back into burlesque and vaudeville. But also it kind of comes out of that Circus Oz fruit fly tradition. Some of those acts that kind of grew up a bit and got a bit more risque and kind of went through that way. And it has its own tradition. And then there's this tradition of stripped back group acrobatic circus. And I think that part of that comes from kind of the some of Acrobat's work back in the day, some of the kind of more focused, sort of acrobatically focused acts and people that came out of Circus Oz, Fruit Fly Circus, but also then circus work, which had quite a radically different point of origin, but really brought that into what we talk about as being the third wave of kind of Australian contemporary circus, which is this stuff. So this is this kind of current wave of group acrobatics inspired work. And that very much, I think, we didn't start it, but I think we created the model of, acrobatic mats covered in Mali, group of people not wearing a whole lot of fancy clothes, basically doing acrobatics and making that an expressive art form. I think circa. I think, like a lot of things, we aren't necessarily there anymore. It's not maybe what we try and do. Some of it's a house style, a cliche. I kind of go, well, if that's the third wave, then what's the fourth wave, fifth wave? Our job should be to discover that. So we're doing at the moment collaborations with opera companies, working with architects, creating work I'm in rehearsal for a show that uses live video and has water on stage. I have, there's a bunch of different kinds of adventures that we're on, and I don't know where any of them are going to lead, and maybe they'll all just kind of fizz out. And we know that, evolution is not a teleological process. It's not aimed at a particular end. It just kind of happens. And that's, I think, very much what, you know, it makes sense when you look backwards. It doesn't make sense when you're living it. You're just kind of following your artistic nose mostly and trying to stay in business.
So I've only been to Australia once, which is where I met Lauren Eisinger, who is working with you on your podcast.
She is indeed. And she's a great addition to our team. Fabulous.
She's brilliant. And she's actually been on our podcast before, so listeners can go back and hear Lauren's journey.
Fringe festivals.
But one thing we learned bringing our show to the Adelaide Fringe Festival was just how different audiences are in different countries what is funny and what isn't funny and what even circus-wise, trick-wise gets a clap versus not. And New York in particular has a super low bar for skill, but a very high bar for what you're trying to do intellectually. Whether or not it's good, that's what people are looking for. I'm wondering if there's, you know, Circa has been presented really all around the world. If there's any sort of big takeaways from how playing in Europe is different from America, from Asia, from Australia.
Look, there are a whole lot. I think the first thing is to be super conscious of the things that are going to stand in your way. And to work out if you can live with them. So we have a beautiful children's show, Wolfgang's Magical Musical Circus. It features a slow motion, obviously comedic fight between a man and a woman set to one of the most exquisite pieces of music, the Adagio from Mozart's Clarinet Concerto, in which they fight, they knock each other out, and they're healed then by music and makeup. So it's not decontextualized violence. American presenters for children's work won't have it because a man is seen to punch a woman in the course of that fight. Even though I don't cast genderedly, they're a husband and wife, they punch each other. Like, there's nothing in that world that is not justified or contextualized. But if we don't take that scene out, we can't present the work in America, in many venues in America. So you have to decide, are there actually just obstacles to meeting that audience? You know, if you use the word fanny in America and Australia, it means something different. So you have to decide, do I want to translate it or do I want to leave it in its ambiguity? I can't just use that word and assume that people will understand it. But that's a fairly minor class of things that you can, as a presenter or you know, someone taking a risk, you need to kind of figure out. And you don't always know in advance. Beyond that, I think what our shows try and do is teach the audience how to watch them in the show. Because I see each show that we make, like some of them are kind of similar because I create most of them and often out with similar kinds of people, you know, the same people and mostly the same cast moving forward. So, of course, there are similarities, but I'm looking for differences and I try and take the audience on that journey. If I do that right, the audience by the end of the first 10 minutes of the show isn't in Adelaide or New York or Berlin. They're in Wunderkammer or Peep Show or Circa or Humans or Opus, and they're in that show, and that show teaches them how to watch it, and that's part of the transformative power of art. How long I can keep them there for, I don't know. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but I also don't do a lot of comedy because I find comedies too intellectually taxing. It's just like, it just hurts my head. You know, tragedy is easy. Just kind of go slowly and kill someone every now and then and you're fine, you know, drop them or something go wrong with comedy. It's like, you know, so precise and so intellectual that it just, you know, and I think that has more variety, more variance between audiences, but mostly I think shows create their own worlds and audiences of people.
When you start working on a new show or devising a new piece, where do you typically start? Is it like a song or a feeling or a world or, you know, a collaborator?
It's kind of all of those things, but often it's a really dumb idea that I said to someone that then kind of stuck with me, that either stuck with me and wouldn't go away, and sometimes that period is years, or that somebody picked up on and went, yeah, let's do that, and I went, yeah, let's do that, and then like 6 months later or 3 weeks later I'm in a rehearsal room going, why did I ever think that was a good idea? That was ridiculous, badly thought through, misconceived, non-strategic, no one's going to want to see it. And then you kind of just eat your own intestines for a couple of months and then try and put on something that you can live with.
Is that answer?
Yeah, that does.
So speaking of creating things, I also wanted to ask, what was the impetus for creating your podcast, Producing Heroes, which I've been enjoying all six episodes, probably by the time this gets released, a few more out there. You know, for us, the reason we started this podcast a few years ago was because I felt like there was this hidden knowledge in people who had started circuses or had found their way to the peak of whatever their circus discipline was. And there was not a good way to share it. And I'm not really a great reader, but I can listen to people talk and absorb it. So that felt like a much more natural thing for us. But your podcast is so focused specifically on creative producing. I'm curious as to why you wanted to take it in that path, and what kind of guests that, you know, you wanted to highlight.
Look, I started for exactly the same reason. I mean, I think I couldn't hear the conversations that I wanted to hear with the kinds of people that I admired greatly. I always feel like there's this deep asymmetry in our business where, you know, every performer that I know, every director that I know, every writer kind of thinks we're pretty great and that, you know, we're super talented. And every producer that I know sees themselves as a kind of humble servant of art and artists. But actually, they're really smart and they're really creative and they're really talented. So I see them as being like the unsung heroes of our industry. And if you think about it, there's not a lot of conversations you've had that go, I wish there were more acrobats and directors in the world. It might be we might want better ones and more inspiring ones, but in terms of bulk, it's like we've probably got enough. I've never had a conversation where someone says, we don't need more producers. We don't need more people to go out and take a risk, dream the impossible things, make them happen, help us make them happen. And for me, that's a really, you know, I think it's a powerful testament to a very kind of hidden part of the industry. They're our friends. We work with a lot of inspiring people. I mean, it's been, you know, incredibly easy. Everyone said yes. So it was incredibly easy to pull together a list, and we've got, you know, a second season that worth of people who want to do it. And I'm really proud of the relationship we've had with our creative producers, you know, and I kind of think about my experience in New York City working with Joe Malilo that it took 10 years before the first time we had correspondence to us bringing the show to BAM. When I look at the Lincoln Center at Jane Moss and John Nakagawa and what they did bring us to their Union Seminary Hall and how hard it was to find a space in New York for this show and yet how they stuck with a very complex and expensive show featuring us in a music ensemble from England, Ifedjalini, and how they kind of really just went to extraordinary lengths to make something possible that really shouldn't have been possible. Or working, you know, with Mark Baller and Symmetries around the UK with three or four different partner organizations, multiple levels of creatives, and think, why would you do that for somebody else's vision? Why would you do that to support a, you know, ungrateful artist to kind of feather their own nest? And you kind of, so when you hear these people, I just go, I'm just in awe. You know, I think they just do extraordinary things, and I wanted to celebrate that and provide a resource, because if you can't know, it's hard to kind of want to be something if there's no one talks about it. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, you know, how do you know you want to be a producer? And if you are studying to be a creative producer somewhere, what's your resource? So I put it together thinking, you'll notice in it, I'm not, mm-hmm. I'm obviously very aware of, you know, coronavirus, Black Lives Matter, and the kind of very pertinent issues for the day. And while we don't shirk those, if anyone wants to talk about them, it's not been the focus of the series. The series has been talk about your practice and your journey and your advice, because I'm hoping that in 10 years' time, people will be, the issues, there will still be issues. They may be the same, they may not. They may be environmentally, you know, they'll probably be, well, how do we stop the planet from burning, and why can't we, you know, income inequality and whatever those issues are. But I'm hoping that the lessons, if you believe in the fundamental goodness of theatre and its ability to bring us together as a species, that those lessons will be important. And I want people to be listening to the podcast at universities and, you know, college courses, people who are kind of studying or thinking about being creative producers. Yeah. That makes sense.
Excuse me. Like I said, Josh and I met at grad school, but we met for theatrical producing, actually. And
We hardly have any of that in Australia.
Well,
we
it's already very Broadway focused in America. So when you say theater producing, that's what people, what everyone goes to the course.
Our whole curriculum was focused mainly on commercial productions on Broadway. A little bit of non-for-profit, but really a little bit of touring, but really Broadway. And, to graduate, you had to write at least a 50-page thesis. And my thesis was about how we should be funding producers with grants and not artists. And it was a very, controversial statement, I think, because a lot of people are like, well, you should give this money to the artists. But there's like 2,000 plays that get written every year in America to 200 plays that get made. And it's like, if you could fund a producer to produce more art, then I think more plays would be done.
Absolutely. Look, I think the interesting thing, we have this on a company level as well. I mean, it's difficult on an organizational level in times of COVID to justify why, I'm in an office, I have a job, but our whole company is employed. And when you look at the value we create as a sector, every dollar of funding we get produces over $2 of employment for artists. Mm-hmm. If you want to double the number of artists employed, you give the money not to artists. That's the reality, right? It's a very unpopular reality.
Yes.
But the figures are really clear. Another figure that's interesting here in Australia is every dollar of federal government money that goes to the subsidized arts produces $1.14 in tax return to the government. So actually, we're a 14% value-add investment scheme, and the government should just keep giving money to the arts because they get it all back. Because what we do with that money is we employ artists. And you can't employ artists unless you've got things for artists to do. Mm-hmm. So you don't employ artists by just going out and writing checks to artists. You go and say, I need to create an opportunity, whether it's a training course or whether it's a community engagement program or a show. But you have to create the thing. And that takes a huge, that also employs a whole lot of other people in that process. And they are unpopular truths because it's a lot more woke acceptable to say, we should give money to artists. Let's give money to artists. If you want to halve the number of artists employed, this is what the data tells us in Australia, give it to artists. I would love that not to be true because I come as this as a company director and an artist. But I'm telling you that if you gave me the same funds that you gave Circa, I would employ, there's no way I'd be able to employ as many artists as I can with the infrastructure, the producing capacity, the kind of organization that I have at Circa to be able to employ, create long-term sustainable employment for artists. I couldn't do it. I'd have a great car. I'd put on some cool shows that I really liked. Maybe the art would be better. I'm not talking about the quality of the work necessarily, but there'd be far fewer people employed.
Well, do you feel like the grants that I think exist in Europe and maybe also exist in Australia, where it's an artist who applies for it for an idea for a show that they have? Because I also think that the role of the producer is lost on a lot of people. And it's like all these artists are like, oh, it's so hard to make my own show. It's so hard to keep it going. But the role of the producer is to lift the show and to keep it going and to find a life after just that one show that you do for a grant.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I think creating the conversation around funding is not a particularly useful thing. Funding is one part of a kind of an ecosystem of ways of support and engagement. What I think we all know is that if you can find audiences for your work or clients for your training or whatever it is, or corporate events, then your business, your kind of enterprise has got more chance of going, surviving or prospering. You know, the management guru Peter Drucker says that the purpose of a business is to create a customer. And I think that's not actually a bad philosophy to have. I don't think you need to drive that towards commercialism. I don't think you need to say, well, we need 200,000 audience members all to love the color and movement spectacle of the show. I think you'd say there's 50 people who will come for one night and have a profound experience and, you know, really love what they see and engage with it. And that's as valid, but they have, there has to be somebody there and they have to pay something for the experience. I love when I was talking to Joe Malilo about the Merce Cunningham works, particularly the famous piece of BAM where Robert Rauch, where John Cage had made the first electronic piece of music, and the electrical union and the audio union couldn't agree on who turned the thing on. So the first, it was actually played in silence because nobody would turn on the computer.
But what he said to me
was, you know, we're in the 2,500 seat Howard Gilman Opera House. The thing about John Cage is about the Merce Cunningham shows, there were never more than 500 people in the audience at those legendary performances. That's what was there. It changed American culture. It became the most, you know, among the most important living choreographers in the world. It didn't ever had more than a couple of hundred people in the audience. I think it's important to recognize that cultural impact, artistic validity, where you sit in the conversation is not connected directly to box office or grant base. But we have to try and find our kind of way of balancing all of those different factors. Circa's core grants is, you know, at most we're kind of 20% grant funded. Most of our money is earned. We kind of, it's always a fight. We never have enough. And yet we commit to employing our artists very unusually for the circus world, are employed year round. They're employed whether or not they do shows. And that creates a kind of very different dynamic here.
I bet. I mean, it gives you a fixed overhead you have to hit no matter what.
Yeah. Yeah. So every year after we've employed our artists and run the organization and we take off grant funding, we've got kind of $1.5 million to make. Mm-hmm. So I kind of think that as about 15 things that make us about $100,000. Mm-hmm. And they can be a tour, a big season, a collaborative project. But 15 is quite a lot. Over the course of a year when you've got two and a half kind of productive units. So you pretty much need them, and 100,000 is quite a lot of money to net in a month, especially if you're coming from Australia. So the economics are like up against us, but you know, we're here after 20 years and we're fairly hopeful that we'll be here after another 20.
Do you guys have a lot of individual donors as well?
Very few. Our corporate philanthropy, there's a couple of things we're really bad at. Corporate philanthropic support is one of them. As I say, our diversity work has been, you know, it's been present, but it is subpar. I think our ability to find a genuine commercial success, something that kind of generates profit, enough profit beyond itself to really, you look at it and go, yeah, that will pay for the, you know, we'd love a Lion King. I was kind of trying to hint when I was doing Ed Stewart and the podcast. I just figure out how we can make a Lion King and we'll be there. Because, you know, I'd love to be having, you know, if you think about I think about the good we could do if we had a lot of money coming in that we weren't taking out of the funding pool that's always going to be limited. It was coming from the buyers, ticket buyers somewhere else, apart from the artistic, you know, goodness that hopefully we bring, we could do extraordinary things. But yeah, so far those things, there's, you know, a number of things have eluded us.
So a question back to sort of the producing, the creative producing realm. I think there's just general knowledge that, you know, theater or plays in particular is the playwright's medium. People tend to say like TV or movies is the director's medium. And I feel personally like circus is the producer's medium out of all of the mediums, in part because the thing isn't usually pre-created. You have to
That's right.
create it. And therefore you get a bigger role. But on the flip side, then we work with a lot of people who we bring in from other disciplines. So like our set designer is a famous crochet artist, for example. So she's not coming in with preconceived notions either. But when you do work with people who are from that regular theater background saying, yeah, I'm the lead producer, but I also have quite a relevant artistic voice in this conversation and I'm sitting talking to the lighting designer, is is unusual, I think, at least compared to what people consider a producer in the U.S. So I'm wondering if you can speak to that and if you feel like circus does act differently than other disciplines with the producer.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that the circus has the great ability that kind of any bit of it has its own internal consistency. Like it's kind of more of a solid than a fluid or something. I don't know what the right metaphor is, but it hangs together. So if you take 2 minutes of a juggling act or a trapeze act, it's a thing. So really you can reskin it. You can make it contemporary. You can make it traditional. You can change the music or the lights or put it in a cemetery or put a cathedral or a theater. And all of those things will kind of change how it's received. But at the core is this kind of fundamental fact that somebody has spent a huge part of their life hurting themselves and being incredibly dedicated and taking their talents and refining it to make something. And essentially what we're doing is we're repackaging it. Like at the end of the day, there's not that much, like the three high that we're working on the room has an extra twist, happens in a certain lighting state, gets into and out of a different way, but it's the same skill. And so a lot of really what we're doing is producing it. We're taking it and saying, let's put it in. You know, I remember there was a time when our friend Seven Fingers were on stage with Pippin and they were on stage with Queen of the Night and they were on stage, there were like three different shows in New York.
Yeah.
And they were all different, but they were all kind of the same. Like they were all the same. They were still doing hoop diving and bar and everything. Yep. But they were also just reskinned. The difference between those is entirely producerial. It was kind of, it wasn't like anybody woke up and said, I've got a radically new vision for what these group of artists are going to do in this context. It was more like someone said, let's try and make an immersive show in this cool, found, you know, old ballroom. And that was a great thing to do with those skills. Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny. Whenever I see circus, I think Gypsy also helped a little bit on the Moulin Rouge. There's like a Silks moment. And,
Broadway musical.
Yeah, the Broadway musical, Moulin Rouge. Mm-hmm. And when I see like a theater take little moments from circus, it's like, oh, they didn't really understand what you could do with that moment, you know, but you're right, it is just all packaged differently.
Yeah, I mean, and look, I mean, the same can be said for meat. You know, like you can cook a steak differently, but it's still essentially a cow, dead cow. Like it's still a thing. And that doesn't denigrate the skill or the reason why in one place you pay $5 and one place you pay $65. It's just the class, the sauce, the presentation, the service around it. Like they're all a part of the experience. Like there's nothing inauthentic about that. It's just that we get kind of hung up on very small differences between, you know, there's always like the small thing and the big thing. Like the small thing is, you know, when you run, it's like, well, did I run 7 kilometers a day or 12 kilometers a day? Did I run fast at 520 per kilometer or 540? The big thing is I'm running. Right? The big thing is I got out there and I'm actually running. Like really everything else is a small thing. But if I go, I'm running and I ran, that's the big thing. In circus, the big thing is talented individuals working as in part of something, performing to an audience, right? That's the big thing. Everything else is kind of little things. The difference of which little things and finding the right little things to get it in the right way is absolutely the producer's kind of art. And as a director, most of what I do is try and find essentially producing opportunities through other people often, but I'm looking at a project. I'm saying, what can I do with our Rite of Spring? What can I do with our... How do I make this show that's about these incredibly strong female performers that we're working with and getting their voices and textures out into the public? How can I make a show that takes advice, that comes back from COVID and uses the kind of the smallness and the intimacy of the audience? How can I produce a show with community members when we can't do the show in empty opera houses in Austria? How do I find the kind of, how can I interact with public art installations, musicians, orchestras, operas? How do we find, what are the kind of conversations we can have with this broader art form? But it's the core. If somebody can't hang on a trapeze or juggle or do some incredible skill, none of it makes sense.
One more just sort of question about a lot of the circus shows that I've seen is the music choices that you guys use. And I as somebody who does not know a lot about classical music, maybe even calling it classical music is the wrong word for it. But, you know, most of our work, at least these days, has been all to hip hop and very contemporary work. So I can speak to why that music speaks to us so much and why we like it. But I'm wondering if you can speak to some music you're drawn to and how it matches with the circus.
Yes. I mean, we've been working with a range of things. And partly what you see in New York is a kind of fairly limited sample set. And of course, the classical music appeals to posher venues, or at least more well-resourced venues, tend to be the ones that can afford to bring an Australian company to New York, where things are prohibitively expensive to do. But I do a lot of work with classical music, with kind of, I don't know what you call it, either art music or posh music or non-popular music. And I think it's one of the great gifts we can give is to make people, 2,500 people, sit and listen to Shostakovich string quartets that they've never heard before, and suddenly they make sense because they're actually right. I think I have no problem with any form of music. Like, I think music, one of its great things is it is a broad and generous church. But I think that when you come to the kinds of extraordinary creativity that's gone into a lot of the musical heritage of Western civilization, we are talking here very much about Western art music, right? And that's not an unproblematic concept, but if we park the unproblematicness of it, the problem of it to one side for a moment, it's an extraordinary thing we have, and we're not listening to it anymore. So if you go to a concert hall, it's full of really old people. That's the truth, right? And the problem with that is that if we lose the capacity to listen to Mahler or Beethoven or Shostakovich or Monteverdi, we lose the intelligence that our ears need. And if we lose that, if we, you know, I love, you know, I was listening to Beyonce's Lemonade the other day with some friends. I love great, you know, and I, you know, Ragnar Kjartansson's The National, you know, A Lot of Sorrow, where he had them play their song Sorrow for 6 hours. We were listening to that the other day. And, you know, I think that, like, the musical conversation today is rich. It's beautifully produced. It's got so much to offer. But harmonically, melodically, kind of spiritually, we have this incredible tradition of music that's really in danger of being lost. People don't know how to listen to it, and concerts don't listen to it because most of the music is seen as being contemporary music. It's too difficult. It's too turns you off. So you go back and listen to the same schlocky Shostakovich, Tchaikovsky symphony, or, you know, same set of usual Mozart things. We can change that, because when someone does something cool in front of an orchestra or with an opera, they don't even listen in a way, but of course they do. And what we do is connected, and we can, you know, we can kind of go a little bit balancing on it. You know, you can see the music. And I think that that's a gift we can offer. It also is a gift we can offer that in that realm of the producing thing allows us to be in contact with kinds of people that bring resources. So we're the, you know, we're the second, third circus company ever to go to BAM. We were, I think, the only circus company ever to be in the White Light Festival, the Lincoln Center. We're not taking money out of the resources or the kind of producing places that where circus normally gets its resources from. We're opening doors. We're adding people to say, well, we'll have more circus, thanks, because that worked. That's good. We're building value for a sector, and we're kind of opening people's ears and hopefully hearts to different kind of art forms.
It's so interesting that you say that, because one of my first jobs when I moved to New York over 10 years ago was working at Carnegie Hall and for marketing, which was very hard because, you know, how do you get new audiences in when it feels like a very stuffy, you know, elitist space? How do you get young people in to feel like you're part of this conversation? And it honestly was a hard place to work. But BAM somehow does do that in a way that Carnegie Hall just can't figure out, and Lincoln Center does too, where it feels exciting. And the first time I saw Circa was at BAM. I didn't even think about the correlation.
No, it was an extraordinary place to be. I think that's right. I mean, BAM is one of those kind of extraordinary venues. It's you know, it right place, right time, great leadership, you know, the rise of Brooklyn, the kind of the cool, the not Manhattan itself. But like, there's a lot of reasons why I think, you know, Joe, now David Binder, there's a lot of reasons why I think it's well positioned and has done an extraordinary job. These things are also kind of cyclical. I mean, it now has to deal with, you know, the Shed, it has to deal with Park Armory, it has to deal with, you know, a range of other really kind of challenging and changing demographics. My instinct is that, you know, you can't, because I think this is an infinite game. I don't think my job is not to win or beat anyone else. My job is to stay playing the game and to try and make the game put more kind of energy and more resources into the game as a whole. That way everyone wins. And that's not to say that we're saints. We do pursue things vigorously, but it's to say that ultimately it's not, we win, someone else loses. If we've been to BAM, you know, in New York, we've been to New Victory, Skirball Center, Wildlife Festival, BAM, Fall for Dance at the City Center. And I'm really, you know, some of those places hadn't had circus before. And I'm really pleased at having been able to do that. And, you know, as well as upstate New York, Purchase was the last place I was on tour a couple of months ago. So I, for me, that conversation is a conversation about bringing art and audiences together and creating some kind of value and some kind of energy. If we can do that, then we've done something good.
So I know it's early morning for you, so you're going to have to jump into rehearsals for a little bit, but I would like to wrap up with the same three questions we've asked all of our guests and get your take on them. I know one of them is actually kind of like yours, but I feel like we have grandfathered in our questions, so we're safe. But the first one being, is there a piece of advice, either amazing or terrible, that somebody has given you and really stuck with you?
Yeah, absolutely. The challenge is just narrowing it down, I think, to one piece of advice. One of my former chairs, she said to me, no one is going to care about you until you care about them. And that always struck me as being quite a good piece of advice. I really like the Bob Sutton, the management guru's kind of management professor's no arsehole rule. I think don't be an arsehole is a really pretty good piece of advice.
Great pieces.
Yeah.
So thanks. The second question I feel like is actually the most similar to one you ask, but for somebody who's a student of any age, really, but particularly looking at circus, other than the work you've created, is there a show or a book or a movie that you would recommend as a reference that, you know, somebody check out to inspire them?
I would say you have to go a little bit Mahler on it. Mahler used to say that a symphony needs to contain the whole universe. I think the least interesting thing to look at is other circus. The most interesting thing to do is to educate yourself. And that's, I can say that because that's a process that I think is an endless process, and it's a non-judgmental process. It's the verb of kind of educating rather than the I am educated. It's not a past tense. I think the more you know, the more you've experienced, the more you understand and have tried, whether it's movement forms to listening to music. I mean, if you know, to all persuasions and all types, encountering contemporary art practice and feeding off it. I think if you need to be voracious for other people's work. I mean, everything that you encounter in a major art gallery, right, is one of the best works of one of the best artists that's had years put into it. So when you have that experience that we all have and you walk through a gallery and you see a painting and well, you know, I don't like that or I don't get it, stop. Stop at the one you don't like. Study it. Read up. Google the artists on your phone, figure out why it's there, because somebody, it's got thousands of hours of work behind it, much more than you will probably ever have in your career. And you will probably never be as famous as that artist on that wall. So even if you hate it, that's totally valid. Figure it out. Yeah. Ask the questions. I think being really, really curious is the most important thing. Like, generous and curious, I think, are the only ways to kind of get through, make sense of this kind of crazy ride we're on. So really putting some attention into, paying attention to it all, and not, yeah, I don't think there's a single thing, and I think my thing will be different to yours, which is good and right.
So for our final question, it's a very broad, open question, but who do you think we should have on our podcast?
That's a great question. Well, obviously, I'm going to say creative producers. and there's, in the, you can find plenty on our shows. Look, what I'm most keen to hear about at the moment are voices that I don't normally get to hear. I feel like, particularly in the work that we're doing in the diversity space at the moment, the voices that get heard are the loudest and the most strident. But most of my conversations with people in my sector are quiet, they're private, they aren't virtue signaling, tub thumping kind of displays of wokish superiority. They're actually deep, meaningful conversations, and those voices can be really hard to hear. We've tried, there's a few, you know, we've got some diversity in our podcast coming up, but not enough. And I'd really like to hear people who are working in community, people who are working from a place of diversity, that are not there as the shouters, but are there as the kind of listeners and engagers, because most of us can only ever be allies. We can only ever be part of helping. And to understand what that is, I think we need to have a more nuanced understanding and a more kind of different ways of engaging, not just a slogan on our Facebook page, which costs nothing and does, I don't think, very much. It doesn't hurt, but I don't think it does much. But actually real conversations. I don't know where you necessarily access a lot of those people, particularly in circus. I think it's difficult to find, but I'd certainly be really keen to listen to what they have to say.
Well, keep an eye on our upcoming guest list. I think we haven't found too many, but we found a few good ones that, you know.
That's great. Yeah. Look, and I think just the chance to hear their voices, to hear voices that you don't normally hear, and voices like, you know, I so value the conversations, the sidebar conversations I've been having with people in the sector. I've been having one with an Australian Indigenous circus artist recently, and it's, you know, it's been kind of eye-opening. They've pointed out things in my perspective, but I've been able to point out things in theirs, and that's how humankind advances. It doesn't advance by, you know, I club you, I get a bigger club and club you back. It comes from, like, let's find things we share and areas we disagree with, and let's work towards some things that manifestly are good, which is people not being oppressed, righting historical wrongs, finding ways forward, and not totally upsetting the apple cart while we do it. That all sounds to me like entirely reasonable and logical.
I don't disagree. Yeah, I think that's a great note to end it on too. Jorunn, thank you so much for talking to us. This is such a pleasure. I've been excited about it now for a little while, so I'm so glad we got to do it.
Thanks for your time any time. Lovely to talk.
Have awesome. A good rehearsal. Great.
Thank you very much. All right.
And that was our interview with Jorunn Lifschitz.
If you like our podcast, make sure to subscribe on iTunes, like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. I think I just said like us on Facebook. Can you like people on Facebook?
I think you can still like people or follow people.
Follow us on Facebook? I don't know. I'm going to start posting more. I always say that, but I really am. Hope you guys have a great weekend.
Talk soon.
Our podcast is also available on Circus Talk, the international circus community's online resource and employment tool. If you are not a member yet, register and find your spotlight with Circus Talk today.